I'm an addict. My name is Biff. And this is the 50th Anniversary History Conference in Nashville, Tennessee, October 3rd to the 5th. The recording from this conference belongs to the public domain. The next speaker is Mel H. from Southern California. He will be celebrating 35 years in a few days, and we're going to discuss, among other things, what the meetings were like when Mel came in compared to what they're like now. What I'm going to ask Mel to do, and then just give him the microphone, is take us to an NA meeting in the 60s when he came in and talk about how they introduced themselves, what was the format of the meetings. He talked a bit about having step study meetings. What did they use to study the steps with? What was a typical addict sharing sounding like at meetings in those days? How did they close their meetings? What did they do before and after the meetings? Those kind of things, so that if we could get a flashback of the 60s and see where we've come from to where we are now. Mel?
Okay. Well, I am Mel, and I'm an addict. And those meetings were, you made me stop and think about a lot of stuff. And those meetings in the early days were meetings where we kind of showed up early. If it was an 8:30 meeting, which most of the meetings were 8:30 meetings at that time, we would show up a half hour early to chat and catch up. Sometimes, in fact, we had some people we had to chase out of there with the they'd set up their jewelry racks and want to sell things. So merchandising was almost an early thing in NA. That was kind of funny. Most meetings were around tables where you'd have one table at the head and then two tables off to the side and chairs around it. And then they had a lot of settings for chairs afterwards. It seemed like the popular people or the people that were the regulars would sit around the table. There was smoking at that time. You could smoke in the meeting. And, of course, the newcomers would be drifting into the back end of things. They'd sit at the very back of the meeting. The format of the meeting was pretty much similar in a sense, except we didn't have the basic text in those days. We only had the white pamphlet. And so we'd read out of the white pamphlet, who is an addict, what is the NA program, the 12 steps. And for the most part, we always read the traditions, but that was about the only readings we had. Compared to today, we spend so much more time reading than you do sharing, and I think it dilutes what the meeting's all about, even though it's necessary in a lot of cases. I think they have too much reading. And we'd have open discussion meetings. Periodically, I would get involved and say, I'm going to make it a topic meeting. I'd pick a topic and say, hey, this is what we're going to talk about. And so we'd have topical meetings, and we'd share on that particular topic unless somebody was pressed to share on maybe something else. We didn't have time limits back in those days. There's an awful lot more swearing than there is today. I think they always used colorful words to describe how they really feel, and the tougher you were, the more colorful words you'd use. Most of the time, they'd ride up, be chased away out of neighborhoods because of the motorcycle noises. I mean, everybody had to have a Harley and play the part. In fact, I always thought to myself, this program is a program of growth. You grow or you go. And I always see people staying about where they were. In fact, I know guys that stayed clean for 20 years and still acted like they did when they were a newcomer. And I always question that, why. And some of those people would still be a representation of people that were staying clean no matter how you acted. And then other people, maybe I'm being too judgmental. And I shouldn't be, but I would always say that, in order to grow in this program, number one, you've got to clean up all areas of your life, and that includes your language, and be more responsible to other people. The sharing was more a war story in the early days because they didn't know how else to share. They were too afraid to say, I'm afraid. There was not letting your feelings out were kind of a sign of maybe weakness in some cases versus strength. And today it's the strength that really counts more than anything. You need to show your strength by being able to describe how you really feel. And at the end of the meeting, because you can go on with that. Then, at the end of the meeting, we would use the either the Serenity Prayer, or a lot of times we'd use the Lord's Prayer. Now I understand today that they don't really want you to use the Lord's Prayer too much, and I'm thinking, well, why? That's a good prayer. But and there's times that they'll ask me to make the closing prayer, and I'll just blurt that right out, and hopefully nobody will try to slap me down. But that's what I do. I mean, I'm just going along with old stuff. The old meetings, too, you could use the word sober. Didn't mean anything. The old days, we didn't have any real literature other than that white pamphlet. To do a step study meeting would be kind of comical because there would be two ways to do it. Number one, you'd have to take it out of the white pamphlet. But before you came to that meeting, you should have taken the 12 and 12 out of that liquid program and studied it before you got to the meeting, because it wasn't really nice to break out that 12 and 12 in an NA meeting without people wanting to beat you up. So you'd have to study the step before you got to the meeting to be prepared to share on what that step meant to you. I thought that was kind of cute, but that's what we had to do in those days, because if we wanted to know about the steps, we had to have something. And the only thing that was available was what was available, and that's what we had to use. The best part about the meetings, other than gaining too much weight, was the meeting after the meeting, and that was always at some coffee shop. We'd have favorite coffee shops to harass. And we'd leave the meeting at 10:30, probably 10:15 or 10:30, and we'd all congregate at a coffee shop and stay there until sometimes midnight. And that's where we really got to know one another, bonding with one another, crying with one another, laughing with one another, setting up our next date with one another. I mean, there was you talk about stuff that we did, that's the stuff we did. But that's how we got to know each other. And as the meetings have grown, that's an early 60s meeting, that's or late 60s meeting, 60s, 70s meeting. And as time flew and the meetings grew, then you'd split off into not necessarily special interest groups, but people that were bonding in their own circles, and they'd go to their own places. And not everybody fit in. The early meetings were like that. The early meetings were a lot of fun. I mean, you really knew each other. You really knew each other. It would be like seeing these guys here today, Bill Beck and Bill B, seeing Gene, seeing some Sally, even Mary Jane, who I didn't know that well, or Sylvia, who I just truly loved. Sylvia is just a great lady. And her brothers were very instrumental in getting me where I'm at today. In fact, Hank was the guy that carried the message in the penitentiary. And when he died, I had to go, after my sponsor died, I was going to go to Hank and ask him to be my sponsor. And it turned out that Hank died and I had to go to George. And George was the next brother who had been clean a little longer than I think for Hank. And George is my sponsor to this very day. And that's something I never brought up, how important that was. You know, we talked a lot in the early days about having somebody to as a sponsor. You needed a sponsor to show you how the steps work. Doesn't necessarily mean that guy's going to become your best friend, but to at least have a model of what the steps were all about. Here's the interesting part, is that you had to find a sponsor to work the steps. Otherwise, that's the blind leading the blind. I remember my first 10 or 11 years, I mean, I was active in the program but never did the action. I mentioned that in shearing. And so I had people ask me to sponsor them, but none of them ever stayed clean. It wasn't until I started working the steps that anybody ever stayed clean. So, you know, and those guys always kept me on my toes. If you haven't worked something and they're asking you a question, you better get yourself together and start working it, and so that you have the answers. Otherwise, again, it's the blind leading the blind. So that's really important stuff. It's not anything. In fact, I looked at this NA program as a life thing to never take unseriously. You have to take this thing as serious as a heart attack. If you joke with this program is not going to be the one that's going to let you down. The only person that's going to be let down is yourself. You're going to go out and get loaded and do all kinds of bad things. It's going to cause you nothing but headaches and grief if you don't die first. And the only person you have to blame is yourself, because here it is, God's gift. Narcotics Anonymous is God's gift, and we have to use it. In the early days, we looked at that as we need to do something about this stuff. We need to prepare ourselves. We had no idea that the numbers were going to be so vast around the world, especially. And I will take a little bit of that back in a sense because of Jimmy. Jimmy had the dream. Jimmy shared with me so many times. He'd call me up, and I'd call him up, and in any way, whether he's calling me or I'm calling him, he'd say, "Mel, you're not going to believe the letters I got from Australia or from this place or that place." He would be on fire, and I would be on fire with him. And the difficulties, as I lived in Whittier, which is about a 40-mile ride to his house, and he'd always want me to come over there. And I'd come over there once in a while, but never that often, and never often enough to really sit down with him and help him write the letters and put the literature out. But I would get in extremely enthusiastic with him with what was going on. Had no idea. No idea. I mean, the World Convention this year brought it really to home to me in my heart. Left me with a lot of tears of how this thing has taken hold in other people's lives so strongly. And I'm so grateful for that. But the early days were a few meetings here and a few meetings there, and we struggled to just keep clean. And you know, the other thing is, though, when we did the 12-step calls, here's another thing that you didn't ask me about, but it basically, 12-step work was something where you'd actually get off your phone and go to somebody's house. And it was asked that you don't go alone, and I understand why. I remember a 12-step call I made on a guy. His name's Joe. I don't know how I remember that. His name was Joe, and he was a cook. And we went over there, and Joe says, "Well, man, I still got some heroin." And I says, "Oh, Joe, you need to go throw that away." He says, "You know, I can't do that." And he handed me the bag, and he says, "Would you do it for me?" And I said, "Well, okay." So I took off to the restroom to flush it down the toilet, and my front of mate was there, and I was looking at this bag, and I was looking at this bag, and I thought, man, nobody would know I could take this and flush the toilet and just put it in my pocket. Man, I'll have me something for later. And the guy realized in his head I was taking a little bit too long, so I was just thinking. So he came in there, and I knew I was busted right there. And he says, "Well, come on, man. Are you going to throw it away or what?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm throwing it away. What do you think? You think I was going to take this?" And I took it through the toilet, and I never felt so grateful. But I understood why you had to go in pairs. You don't make a 12-step call alone, nor do you make, you know, if you have a woman that you're making a 12-step call on, you take another woman. Don't ever take two guys and go to a woman's house. And then let the woman be the one that's sharing, and you just be there to listen. Now with all the things that have taken place, you don't have quite the same commitment. I don't think you see as much 12-step work as you see it in the meetings, but you don't see it anyplace else. I remember that in many of us have shared this of putting up people on your couch, or if you have a spare bedroom, bring them into your home, feed them for a while, get them healthy, take them to meetings, and get them out of there and put them on their way. Now you got recovery houses do the same thing, except that some of them charge, some of them don't. And they serve a purpose, and I'll never put one down. I think recovery houses are just equally important. Bill, in fact, started a reprieve house in Sylmar, and we had meetings out there, and that was an interesting place. Impact House came up after that, and Cry Help out in the San Fernando Valley. And each and every one of those were important. They got people in, they got people clean, they got people back into society, and many of them stayed clean, and some of them didn't. But it didn't really matter. I mean, it did matter that some of them didn't, but, you know, that's life. We have no control over people's lives. I'm clean because I want to be clean, and I'm sure you guys sitting around this table are also clean because you want to be clean, and that's the only reason you're here. Early days were really fun.
How about asphalt recovery? Piling into the cars like y'all were talking about.
Oh, geez. That's really a...
Taking meetings anywhere you needed to take them to start other meetings.
Well, we did that. Let's say we had the big Sylmar earthquake. And that was a pretty nasty earthquake. In fact, all of you hospital had some NA meetings, and all of you hospital fell apart during the earthquake. Impact House was, I believe, out in Panorama City at that time. And I remember living in Whittier. Again, it's a 45-mile ride between just one way. But every night, I would run out to Impact House, load my car up as many. I had a big Grand Prix at that time, so it seated five people, that's including me. And if we put a few people on laps, we'd go to a meeting, just go to a meeting. And it didn't necessarily mean starting a new meeting, just going to a meeting. Taking the people to the recovery, from the recovery houses to meetings, that was really important. I put on just miles upon miles, and I always felt good about it. I always felt good about doing just that. So, but down the road, you know, I don't know how you guys get, but I got kind of burned out after a while, and especially when the gasoline shortage came to be, and I wound up getting a little two-passenger car, and I felt guilty because I didn't have the room to put people in the car anymore to take them places. And my sponsor always told me not never to be lonely. Don't be a lonely companion, because loneliness can only breed bad things. So I did finally get a little bigger sports car, and then you know, I started getting bigger cars again. So, but those were the early days. Then we always packed them in. Packed as many as we could and taken the meetings. My sponsor always did, and he says, that's what you need to do. Yeah, that was a lot of fun those days.
What about the early service meetings, you know, area service? We hear all kinds of phenomenal stories, and like everything else, we're not sure how much of it is true. You know, we heard the stories about people coming in and slamming their knives and guns on the table, you know, and all of that insanity, and I've never met anybody who's actually seen that, so I don't know where these rumors came from, but what was service like in the early days?
Service was, I was part of it. I was part of the service.
Well, that's why I asked you.
Yeah, I was part of the early service. The early service, we had our bickering. I can't ever remember anybody getting so upset that there was a fist fight. Oh, well, yes, Gene and Jack Whaley went round and round one time, but I don't think there ever came to blows, nor did it ever come to guns or knives, but we had our differences of opinions. Gene was always really opinionated. Oh, boy, he's going to get mad at me or that. But Gene had his own way of thinking of things, and Gene was not always wrong either. It just meant that he had his own thinking. Sorry, Gene, but I'm sure he's going to get a copy of this. Love Gene. I mean, he really meant well. His heart was always for the new person. It always has been and always will be. But there's other people there that didn't feel quite as strongly about certain issues. And when our business meetings would get nasty sometimes. We would have a little arguments that would lead on and go on and on, kind of led me to think, what am I doing here? I'm a small guy anyway. I mean, I can't, I'm not going to fight anybody. So I became chairman of GSO at one time, and that's when I made that decision to start the world's first convention, because I felt so strongly about that. But we had early days trying to develop a structure. Now, Jimmy, his heart was so big, but sometimes he could be so, excuse me, guys, boring. He would just, he'd get you off in some circles, and he'd say, what is he talking about? And he would start writing stuff down. We met in Bill Beck's barbershop a few times, and we'd have an easel, and we'd draw up some stuff with chalk and an easel, and this is what we were going to do, or a blackboard, and this is what we were going to do, and this is what how we developed, let's say, the tree. And some of the other literature came from just trying to develop some stuff right there. I think we carried it on a little further when we got away from just having GSO. He says, you know, we're going to have areas, then we're going to have, they'll have their own GSOs or things, and then we're going to need a World Service Board. And I thought, well, that's getting pretty big when he's starting to talk about Board of Trustees. And in fact, they moved me from one area to the next area to finally becoming a member of the Board of Trustees. And so I was really impressed. I thought, really? You guys should let me in on this? And they said, well, Mel, you've been pretty active. You're interested in Narcotics Anonymous, and we want you to be a part of. And I thought that was really cool. I really wanted to be a part of that. That was kind of the icing on the cake for me to be. Now, I didn't want that to blow out of proportion. I think some of the things I've shared today is a me, I thing, and I have to say it's not me at all. It's God. God has inspired me. I'm working from him, for him, not for me. I can't take credit for anything that I've done. I've stayed clean, but God's helped me do it. He's pointed me into the people and the places and the things I need to do. So the early business meetings were kind of noisy sometimes. We didn't have as many people showing up as we would have liked. There's always... Again, the looky-whos that didn't want to be involved, and then there was the people that wanted to be involved that were right there. And some were guided well, some were misguided. There was probably a lot of good arguments that happened from that, but still and all, it served its purpose. I've always thought, and I believe that still to this very day, that as we go along, the people that are the most sincere and have the most amount of fortitude, spirituality, honesty, and integrity are going to be the ones that are going to stay. And those that have other thoughts, ulterior motives, are going to weed themselves out, and they're going to go about their business and do something else. So I kind of still see that the Board of Trustees, you've got some good people that are on the board probably today. You've got some great leaders, which are trusted servants, better terminology, that are strong today. And I think NA, because of that, will prosper just unbelievably. World Service Office is just was a dream. And the World Service Office was Jimmy Kennan's front room. And then it grew, and it grew, and it grew. And several years ago, I went through World Service Office. I don't get out that way. I was so impressed with the amount of people that worked there, the warehouse, where the literature had, the routing for literature, the amount of money that Narcotics Anonymous is actually handling through the Seventh Tradition. We struggled at the early days. We dug money out of our pockets. The people on committees would take money out of their pockets to keep things going for postage, for this, for that. And that was in the 60s, late 60s and 70s. We were still struggling. We didn't know if we'd make it. So I don't remember guns and knives. I don't remember that at all, to tell you the truth.
And I don't believe it, but that's, you know, it's Narcotics Anonymous, so it's much more, as you talked about earlier, dramatic than it needed to be. I mean, it has a great sense of drama to talk about. Oh, yes, I remember when the service meetings were. And I'd rather hear what you just had to say, which is like, you were there, and those people who remember when those service meetings were probably never were there. Because everybody I've spoken to from the time that you were there has the same recollection you have. So they remember it being emotional, heated, but even with all of that, afterwards it was all okay. Everybody walked out of the meetings and they were fine.
And they came back the next time. And a lot of times they'd say, whoops, I was wrong, or, you know, no, I still feel that way. It didn't really matter, agreeable or disagreeable, we all somehow managed to stay. And those that didn't stay got loaded. So what's there to talk about with that? If they've gotten loaded, they separated themselves from the one thing that was going to save their lives. And that's not what I ever want to do. If I disagree with somebody, I've disagreed with a lot of people. But so? Didn't mean I had to go get loaded. Didn't mean I had to separate myself. I maybe just didn't go around a particular place for a little while, but until I calmed it down and thought it over. You know, you're learning here to, you're teaching yourself to think, and be careful what you think too. But you're learning to think things completely through. And what is the end result? If you have a resentment, the only person that's going to really know it is you. The other person doesn't even know. Oh, well, unless you make it known.
You have something, Doc?
Yeah, now would you be willing to field a question about 60s PI?
Public information?
Well, here's the question. When I was 15 years old in 67 through 68, I lived in a halfway house run by the Salvation Army called the Manhattan Project. It was right down there, one in Hancock Park, one off of Western. And sometimes the Synanon people would come over and run one of their games along with one of our groups. But that whole year, I never heard of N.A. How can that be? I mean, were you not able to reach out, or were people rebuffing you, or what?
No, it wasn't that at all. In those days, we didn't have that much information. We had the white pamphlet, maybe a couple little flyers, but... we had the Hollywood number listed. I can't remember that number, but I remember seeing on the white pamphlet. I am not certain. Jimmy tried to get some stuff put out, but I think even in those days we were still gun-shy of narcotics officers. All right. I forget about this stuff all the time. You're just bringing up some rehashing some stuff for me. When I got out of the penitentiary October the 7th, 1968, I had to check in with the parole department. And in the parole department, they said, you can't hang around in known addicts. I says, but I want to go to these NA meetings. And they said, well, known addicts go there. I says, known addicts go there, but they're clean. I said, tell you what, you want to test me, and I know that, and that's part of my parole is to be tested. In those days, they put naline into your system. If your eyes changed, you were okay, but if they didn't change, you were on the gray goose going back to the penitentiary. Okay. And I said, I'll tell you what, I want to test every week. I'll voluntarily go every single week. I'll take off, and you tell me the time, or I'll just pick a time, and I'll go. And I'll test. And if I come back here, you can send me back. But I'm going to go to those meetings. And I want to be clean more than I want to go back to penitentiary. So I'm willing to do whatever it takes. I haven't thought about that in years, by the way. That's the first time I've talked about this in years. And I hated going down to that place. And in fact, I volunteered not only to go down there. I said, I'll even be willing to take somebody that doesn't have transportation so they don't have to take a bus. And they looked at me kind of funny, and they said, okay, I'll let you do that. And I went to those meetings, and I told them about those meetings. In fact, I went to 7 to 14 meetings a week. That's how much I wanted to stay clean. forgot to mention that today. But I wanted to be clean more than I wanted to be dirty or going back to the penitentiary. So I did that for a period of time. And then I remember this judge, Leon Emerson. He was the guy that invented the court card. He had a court in Downey. And he invited a bunch of people to come in because he had a program called, well, it was an alcohol school. It was for first and second offenders to go to these programs to hear about recovery. And they'd have a chance to hear about recovery. So I raised my hand and I says, well, Judge, you just have the school for alcohol. Why don't you have it for drug addicts, too? You know, alcohol is the old known drug, and drugs are just substitute for alcohol. So you ought to have a program for addicts as well. And he slapped his forehead and he says, Mel, you're absolutely right. And he changed the name of the program from alcohol school to DANA, which is Drug, Alcohol, and Narcotic Awareness. And so we had first and second offenders going to these different schools. The best part about it was the parole department saw that I was staying clean. They were surprised. And they told me, you know, we don't expect you to stay clean. We're probably going to be sending you back because addicts always get loaded. And a year down the road, here I am still clean, and they're questioning it. Well, how are you doing this? I said, I'm going to these meetings. I told you that's what I was going to do. I volunteered to go test. I'm going to these meetings. And anyway, I recommended that they talk to Judge Leon Emerson. And Judge Leon Emerson got them involved in moderating these schools and having these diversion programs. That's the word I was looking for, diversion programs. And they were all a part of it. Well, down the road, they had my picture up for about 10 years up on a board as the one guy that's made it. and after about 10 years, maybe a little longer than that, a new guy took over command of the parole department at that particular place, and they made the parole officers take that picture off the wall because to them that was, they just didn't want to do that anymore. They didn't want to show that off. But I don't know if that answered the question you were looking for, but
certainly gives the flavor of the time.
Yes, it was a tough time in those days. It was really tough. But
is there anything else you'd like to talk about with those times? Kind of wrap this up. You know, anything you'd like to leave us with, give us a lasting. Well, not that you haven't already given us a lasting flavor of the time, but you know, anything that you carried with you from those times that you think we didn't get the opportunity to have by not being there?
Probably the same things I've shared already. I'm here in Nashville, Tennessee by invitation, but I'm here because I never want the legacy of Narcotics Anonymous to never be known. I never want it to be said that it stopped or started in the early 50s and it ended. It's never going to end. I want it to be known that we all have responsibility, whoever gets these tapes, we all have a responsibility to give back what was so freely given to us. It's let it never be kept as your own little personal thing. It's like having a Hershey bar and not wanting to share it. Share this thing. Give everybody a taste of the sweetness. They're going to feel the bitterness, but they're going to replace the bitterness with some sweetness. And I think that's, I don't know how else to explain it that any other way than just that. You know, it's important that we share what this thing is all about. And I've said it so many times today even, and never stop giving away the hope to a new person. That new person needs to know that. So that when they walk out of a meeting, on their first meeting, they can't say that the hope wasn't offered to them. Whether they take it or not, that's not our responsibility. But it is our responsibility to offer.
That was wonderful. Thank you, Merle. Appreciate it.
You guys bring tears to my eyes.
And vice versa.
This is cool. This is cool.
Way cool.